Good afternoon. I call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect it is 1:33 p.m. on Thursday, April 14th, 2022. Present today are Representative LeBon, Vice Chair Ortiz, Co-Chair Foster, Representative Josephson, Representative Johnson, and myself, Co-Chair Merrick. This afternoon, we will consider Senate Bills 239 and 240, approving royalty oil sales for PetroStar and Marathon Petroleum. And we will begin consideration of House Bill 265, Telehealth, before we have to recess to go to the floor at 2:30. We've been joined by Representative Wohl. We have Johnny Meza, Commercial Analyst with the Division of Oil and Gas, with us today. If you could come forward, place yourself on the record, and begin your presentation. Thank you for being here.
Good afternoon. My name is Johnny Meza. I work in the Division of Oil and Gas, Department of Natural Resources. I believe my Deputy Commissioner of DNR, John Crother, is on the line as well.
Yes, he is. Let the record reflect at 1:34 p.m. we're joined by Representatives Carpenter and Edgman. Okay. Please proceed.
Thank you. The beginning of our presentation will be provided by our Deputy Commissioner, John Crother.
Okay, Mr. Crowther, if you could place yourself on the record and begin the presentation. Thank you for being here.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. This is John Crowther, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. And before we get started today, I just wanted to say, you know, we really appreciate the committee's time to review this important legislation and appreciate the House's prompt consideration of it. You know, the royalty in kind oil sales have been a longstanding part of the state's use and development of its natural resources. It's been an important part of supporting in-state refining capacity, which benefits our consumers with fuel supply and security, benefits the broader economy, and very importantly from the Department of Natural Resources, from our statutory obligations, it's provided additional value from our royalty oil over and above the general royalty and value sales. So I'll turn the rest of the presentation over to our commercial lead, Johnny Meza. But before I do that, I just wanted to highlight the first slide of the presentation is a summary of some of the steps that are required to effectuate these contracts and a bit of explanation about why the department and the administration is seeking the expedited review, which you all have been so considerate to take up today. So if you have any questions about that, myself and Johnny can speak to that, but we, in respect to the committee's time, we just want to move forward to the substance of the contracts and get to the review. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to provide a presentation to you on the proposed contracts for the sale of royalty oil from the North Slope to the in-state refineries. In this presentation, we would like to review some of the contract terms for these buyers, Marathon and PetroStar. Historically, the state has received or elected to receive its royalty oil from the North Slope, both in kind and in value. When doing it in value, the state receives a share of the proceeds from the producers according to its royalty rate in the oil and gas lease contracts, subject to some fair market valuation of the royalty oil. On the other hand, when the state selects to sell its royalty oil in kind, we enter into contracts, and the majority of those times were done with the in-state refineries. So the state has had a history of entering into these royalty in-kind contracts almost since the beginning of production from the North Slope. And the majority of those contracts were dedicated for the sale to in-state refiners. In this slide, you can see a table showing the recent history of royalty oil in-kind contracts beginning in 2016 with Tesoro, who was the previous operator of the Nikiski refinery, and now it is being operated by Marathon. Also with PetroStar, those were multi-year contracts. You also see in the middle of that table contracts for duration of 1 year with Marathon and PetroStar in 2021. And lastly, the two rows, the currently proposed contracts for Marathon and PetroStar designed to last 3 years and 5 years respectively. The third column shows the amount of royalty barrels being proposed to be sold, and also for those previous contracts, the royalty barrels that were sold to these in-state refineries. Moving on to the next column shows the way that the department and these buyers agreed to value the royalty oil, specifically following the, what we call the netback methodology, which in principle mimics the same valuation methodology that we have for our royalty oil in value, with the exception highlighted in blue of this term that we called royalty in kind or RIK differential, which is a negotiated term between the department and the buyers, the in-state refineries. And the last column shows the values of this negotiated term, the RIK differential, throughout the history of these contracts.
Thank you very much. And let the record reflect at when we gaveled in, Representative Rasmussen is with us online. We have a question from Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And through the Co-Chair, so and it's probably maybe here in the slide somewhere, but in general, over time, what's been the best for the state to take it in value or in kind?
Representative Johnson, through the chair, when we enter into a royalty in kind contract, the regulations require that the price that we receive in those contracts be at least as equal as the value of the royalty oil when selecting in value. For the period beginning in 2008 until December 2021, the department has obtained on average a premium of 93 cents per barrel in addition to our royalty oil in value.
Follow up?
And so just to follow up on that then, so what we're talking about here, when we differentiate between in kind and in value, is just that you're wanting to describe to us the chain of events that has happens as it goes through the process. I mean, we're talking about them in two different ways, but essentially it's going to be, well, actually a little bit more, I guess.
Representative Johnson, through the chair, if I understood correctly your question, there is a process, yes, for selecting a royalty in kind, and generating a premium over a royalty in value is one of those requirements.
Representative Wall.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So by looking at this table, the RIK differential is subtracted. It's another deduction in the price, the RIK price, that the state of Alaska would get. So it's, say, around $2 or so, $2.25 per barrel. So that's a reduction that the state gets. And also they don't, basically the oil doesn't have to be transported, although they're deducting. It's normal, the normal price of oil, including all the transportation, plus another deduction. But I'm sure you'll show us in later pages that you make up for it by the refining of the oil, and then whatever happens to it after that, the state gets ostensibly more money, I'm assuming.
Representative Wall, through the chair, that's correct. The RIK differential is another deduction in how we arrive at that price, but even with that, we still generate a premium over our royalty oil in value.
We'll see that.
Yes.
Thank you. Please continue.
Thank you. So this slide just shows a graphical representation of how we determine the price of our royalty oil in value on the left side versus how we do it for our royalty oil in kind on the right side. Like I said earlier, in principle, they are similar in the sense that we apply this so-called netback methodology, beginning with the price of ANS oil in the US West Coast, which is the main market. The majority of that oil is being sold there. And when we take in value, we receive a share of the proceeds from the producers. In other words, the producers, quote unquote, market the royalty oil on behalf of the state, and we receive a share of the proceeds according to our royalty rate, subject to some fair market valuation. In doing so, in arriving at a price of that royalty oil at the field, we need to take into consideration some deductions related to the transportation of that oil. So on the left side of this slide, you can see highlighted in yellow one of the main components of such deductions called the marine transportation allowance. On the other hand, when we sell our royalty oil in kind, and I said earlier that the majority of these contracts are dedicated for the sale of royalty oil to our in-state refiners, that oil is no longer transported to the US West Coast. Therefore, it doesn't have this deduction related to the transportation cost via tankers. In place of that, we have this negotiated deduction called the RIK differential, which in this example is in absolute value less than the marine transportation cost. And the difference between those two, as you can see in these numbers, it is the main source for how the department obtains this premium for royalty in kind. On the right side, $71.75 per barrel, compared to the price of royalty oil in value in this example at $70.50 per barrel.
Thank you. Please continue.
Thank you. The next slide just shows some historical information related to the previous graph. So in the previous graph, I was highlighting the main difference between that marine transportation cost and the negotiated value of the RIK differential. This graph shows the historical value of these two variables. On the blue line in this graph shows the weighted average marine transportation allowance or transportation cost, and the gray line shows the negotiated values of the RIK differential. The vertical distance between those two lines, it is the source of the premium that the department has obtained by entering into these contracts for royalty oil in kind. The dashed line just shows the value of a term that the Department of Revenue calls location differential, which is a proxy of the sales of ANS oil between producers and refineries when they occur within the state. So that's just a metric that we use to compare how our contracts are doing with respect to third-party contracts. Another consideration is because the department provides supply to the refineries, but we are not the only supplier to these refineries, so we also need to consider whether our oil, royalty oil, is competitive with respect to those other alternatives.
Representative Edgman.
Yes, just keeping in mind that this is a bill that I've seen a number of times. I'm not going to use the word pro forma because this, as I understand it, basically sort of reinforces an existing arrangement. That's what the purpose of this legislation does, but maybe to quickly kind of jump to the punchline a little bit, if the gentleman might address the revenue differences to the state that this would generate additional passages.
Representative Edgman, through the chair, certainly, and I would gladly go to slide number nine there. This table shows how much the state, and also related to the question from Representative Johnson and Wall, how much the state has been able to generate in terms of additional revenues with respect to its alternative in value. The current contracts are estimated to generate, for the Marathon contract, between $3 and $14 million, and for the PetroStar contract, between $17 and $19 million, in excess of what we would have received had the state selected 100% of its royalty oil in value.
Follow up?
Just a quick statement, and this is one of the reasons that all the process is important, but this is one of the reasons I'm strongly supporting this in the past. Thank you.
Great, thank you, Representative Edgman. Do you have further slides?
No, Chair.
Okay. If it's possible to go over the fiscal notes, since we're talking about dollars. It looks like for Senate Bill 239, the fiscal note control code is EPVZV. So we'll go over Senate Bill 239 fiscal note first. Mr. Meza?
Yes. So what we did here in estimating the change in revenues for each fiscal year was precisely to decompose the values that I just recited for each of these contracts, those estimates, and allocate them for each fiscal year. Basically, this was an estimation by the department in how those will be decomposed. What you can see there is also that 74.5% of those revenues for each fiscal year are going to be allocated to the general fund, whereas 25% will be allocated to the permanent fund and 0.5% to the school fund.
Great, thank you. And I will note on page 2 of that fiscal note, in the under bill number, it does say Senate Bill 240 in the upper right-hand corner. That is just a typo and will be corrected before it moves on. So then we will go to Senate Bill 240 fiscal note. The patrol code is GJWMS. Mr. Meza?
Thank you, Chair. And for this one, the exercise is the same. The main difference between the actual estimates of the revenues come with respect to the duration of the contract, but also the proposed amount of royalty oil that is being dedicated to this company.
Representative Carpenter. We'll take a brief at... Correct. We'll take a brief at ease. House Finance on the record at 1:55 p.m. Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I just had a question about the previous graphic. Well, that one, on page six. Page six and page five. I'll start with page six. So the difference between the gray line and the green line determines if you make money by doing in-kind versus what the other kind is called. In value. Yeah, thank you. So if the green line differential is above the weighted average, then is that what determines the decision point whether to do in-kind?
Representative Wohl, through the chair, the decision is with comparing the blue line on the top and the gray line at the bottom, because our requirement from regulations is to obtain a price that is at least equal as our royalty in value, and the royalty in value is the one that uses the marine transportation allowance, which is the blue line.
Follow up.
Slide five. On the graph on the left, I understand that's just normal oil going through the pipeline taps, shipped out, all the transportation costs, $80 a barrel. Value is $70.5. On the right side, the refinery graphic looks like it comes right off the field. Is that just graphical? Because if it goes through Petrostar or Marathon, I'm assuming it has to go through the pipeline a little bit. And how does it get there?
Representative Wohl, through the chair, you're correct. It's just that DNR is not in charge of the transportation, or the state is not in charge of the transportation. It is, we transfer the title of our royalty oil at the field. That's why we have a line connecting field one to the Alaska refinery symbol there. The purpose of having those deductions in this graph is just mainly because the pricing of ANS oil begins at the US West Coast. And we sell our royalty oil at the field, so that's why we need to include those deductions.
Representative Wohl.
Thank you. Just for those of us that are more simple-minded, what that means, I understand what it means graphically, but what the oil really does is it goes through the pipeline, goes into the terminal, goes into a boat, does not go to Marathon or Petrostar, but the same value of oil is then, I don't know how where they get their oil, barged up, I guess, but maybe just so I can fully understand it.
Representative Wohl, through the chair, that's correct. So Petrostar obtains the royalty oil as well as other oil that they buy from producers off of taps. And for Marathon, the royalty oil that they take is they do that at Valdez and they barge it all the way to Nikiski.
Follow up?
So they actually pick it up from Valdez. That makes sense. And we sell it at the field. Got it. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Josephson.
Just because we have Marathon is in Nikiski.
Representative Josephson, through the chair, is in North Pole, one refinery, and Valdez, another refinery.
Both are Petrostars.
Correct.
Thank you. Further questions? Mr. Mesa, did you get a copy of the old fiscal note?
I believe so, yes.
Okay, we're going to have Mr. Mesa go over the old fiscal note for Senate Bill 239, which is control code EZBNE. And if there are any changes to that, we can have Mr. Mesa explain those. Has everyone received a copy? Okay, Mr. Mesa.
So in terms of numbers, the way that we decompose the estimated revenue we showed in the previous slide, there isn't a difference with respect to the previous version of the fiscal note. Just to highlight that the allocation to the general fund and the other fund are being done in the same way, with 74.5% to the general fund, 25% to the permanent fund, and 0.5% to the school fund.
Thank you. Questions on the fiscal notes? Seeing none, are there further questions on the bills, either 239 or 240? Representative Carpenter.
Brief at ease.
House Finance on the record at 2:02 p.m. Representative Carpenter.
Chair, so question regarding the oil flowing through the pipeline. In your right slide, the royalty in kind oil is still flowing through the pipeline. There's no, the question I would have then is there an impact to local boroughs or property taxation on that oil because it has a status of royalty in kind, or is it still taxed appropriately through the non-RIK oil as it's traveling through the pipeline? Is there any difference?
Representative Carpenter, through the chair, I believe there's no difference, no impact with respect to how determines the value of property tax of the pipeline.
Thank you. Further questions or discussions before public testimony? Seeing none, I'm going to open public testimony on Senate Bills 239 and 240. Is there anyone in the room wishing to testify on Senate Bill 239 or 240? Seeing none, we will go online. For Senate Bill 239, we have Doug Chapados with PetroStar. Welcome to House Finance, Mr. Chapados. Would you please state your name, affiliation, and begin your testimony?
Thank you, Chair Merrick, and assembled committee members. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
Great. For the record, my name is Doug Chapados, and I'm the President and Chief Executive Officer of PetroStar Incorporated, and I'm testifying today in support of PetroStar's proposed five-year royalty oil contract, which is now before this committee. By way of background, PetroStar is a wholly owned subsidiary of Arctic Slope Regional Corporation and the state's only Alaskan-owned refinery. In addition to fuel distribution terminals located in Anchorage, Valdez, Kodiak, Dutch Harbor, and Interior Alaska, PetroStar also operates two of the state's three commercial refineries, one in North Pole and the second in Valdez, both of which draw crude oil directly from the Trans-Alaska pipeline system. In fact, TAPS is PetroStar's only source of crude oil supply, which means that contracts such as the one before you now are absolutely essential to PetroStar's continued operation. From this crude oil, PetroStar produces a variety of products, including jet fuel for commercial airlines, as well as over 90% of the jet fuel consumed at Department of Defense and U.S. Coast Guard installations located across the state, heating oil for residential and commercial customers, ultra-low sulfur diesel fuels for both on- and off-road uses, including marine diesel fuel, asphalt oil for road paving projects, and specialty low-sulfur turbine fuels for the exclusive use of Golden Valley and Copper Valley Electric Associations. As previously testified to by DNR staff, and as explained in the best interest finding, this contract is good for the state in terms of maximizing the revenues generated from Alaska's royalty oil share. It also benefits Alaskans by helping to maintain the in-state petroleum refining industry and thus preserves competition within the state's fuels market. It is for these reasons that I encourage the committee to approve this RIK contract. Chair Merrick, that concludes my statement. I appreciate this opportunity to address the committee, and I echo the DNR staff's appreciation for the speed with which the committee has taken up this matter and also the full House. I'd be happy to answer any questions at this time.
Great. Thank you very much. Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Chapados, for calling in and including in your comments a little bit of an education about how important PetroStar is to not just the interior, which Representative Wohl and I certainly recognize, but for the whole state of Alaska. Thank you again, Doug.
Thank you. Representative Edgman.
Yeah, I echo those comments. Just a quick question. Given that you have operations in a community, a prominent community in my district, House District 47, but maybe just give you an opportunity to talk about your Alaskan hire percentages.
Surely. Through the chair, Representative Edgman, PetroStar has approximately 275 employees. All but two of those who are located in Seattle are Alaska residents.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I see no further questions. Thank you, Mr. Chapados, for being with us today. We sure appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
And on Senate Bill 240, we have Casey Sullivan with Marathon Petroleum. Mr. Sullivan, welcome to House Finance. If you could please state your name, affiliation, and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair Merrick. Just doing a quick mic check. You got me?
Yes, we do. Thank you.
Very good. Well, thank you and to the committee members of the House Finance Committee for hearing this bill today. And thank you for the opportunity to testify. For the record, my name is Casey Sullivan, and I'm the Government and Public Affairs Manager for Marathon Petroleum. And I'm calling in today to share our support for Senate Bill 240. In short, that the availability, the flexibility, and the stability that this contract offers will absolutely have a positive impact on our ability to optimize our ongoing operations at the Kenai Refinery. I know many of you know, but Marathon's Kenai Refinery is one of Alaska's longest in-state manufacturers, producing quality transportation fuels for Alaska since 1969. And today, after many improvements, that refinery can produce up to 68,000 barrels per day of quality transportation fuels. Our primary focus is on jet and diesel production, followed by gasoline as one of the only gasoline providers in the state of Alaska, but followed by heavy fuel oils, propane, and asphalt, which Doug talked about many of those uses within the state of Alaska. We operate a 68-mile common carrier pipeline that transports jet fuel, gasoline, and diesel to the Port of Anchorage and the Anchorage International Airport. From there, we rail those same products up to the interior, helping to support many of the uses up there as well. In addition to being one of the largest taxpayers in the Kenai Peninsula borough, Marathon provides approximately 250 family-wage jobs at the refinery, along with many full-time contractors that are working in and around the refinery year-round. And in addition, we employ an additional 37 Alaskan operators who work at our terminals in Kisimee, the Port of Anchorage, and North Pole. And just to the previous question about Alaska Hire, you know, all of our direct full-time employees are all Alaskans working across the state of Alaska. So we're really proud of that. And I know, like the speaker before me, you know, we're really proud of our legacy of the employees that work at our refineries and terminals. Many of them are multi-generation employees where their parents or their grandparents worked in the refinery. And so we're seen as that that economic, not only the economic engine for the communities, but as a place to grow and have a career in our industry. And it's really, you can't measure that impact for many of those areas. Continuing just really quick, while much of this contract is essentially a renewal, regardless, it is the result of constructive dialogue and productive negotiations between the Division of Oil and Gas and Marathon. And I just want to say we very much appreciate professional work by the division at all stages of the process and confident that this contract before you will provide a positive shared value to all Alaskans, as they've illustrated. So, you know, in closing, Marathon believes in Alaska's future. And we're absolutely committed to our longstanding legacy of safely and reliably producing quality fuels day in and day out for Alaskans. It's our pleasure to offer our support today. We thank you, committee, for your service to our great state, and we encourage your support for Senate Bill 240. Thank you, Madam Chair. That concludes my remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Sullivan. We appreciate you being here. Any questions from the committee? Seeing none. Is there anyone else online or in the room wishing to testify on Senate Bills 239 or 240? Seeing none, I will close public testimony. And I would just like to make note that these are companion bills to House Bill 409 and House Bill 410. They are exactly the same, just if there was any confusion there. I would entertain any other discussion, questions? Representative Wall.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I just want to, going back to page 9, and you don't have to move it on the screen, but we all have it. It basically says what the estimate additional revenue to the state is, and I just want to applaud the DNR and the administration for, even though we're right now rolling in a lot of oil revenue in the hundreds and hundred millions and billions of dollars, that they're not neglecting to look at numbers between 3 and 4, 14 million or 17 and 19 million, which some might call just, you know, chump change in the world of big Benjamins that are rolling in. But I think it's important to look at numbers between 3 and 14 million, and glad the state is. And, you know, it's on the scale of, say, a rental vehicle tax or something like that. So I'm glad that's not being overlooked.
Thank you, Representative Wool. Anything further from the committee? Seeing none. Thank you, Mr. Meza, for being with us today. That was very informative. And with that, Mr. Co-Chair, is there a motion?
Yes, Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 239, version 32-GS2121/A from committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note, and authorize legislative legal services to make conforming changes.
Is there an objection? Hearing none, Senate Bill 239 is moved from committee. Mr. Co-Chair, do you have a motion?
Yes, Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 240, version 32-GS2122/A from committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note, and authorize legislative legal services to make conforming changes.
Is there an objection? Hearing none, Senate Bill 240 is moved from committee. With that, we'll take a brief at ease. House Finance back on record at 2:13 p.m. With that, House Finance will stand at ease to the call of the chair. House Finance on the record at 4:12 p.m. Next, we're taking up House Bill 265, Healthcare Services by Telehealth, by Representative Sponholz. We last heard this bill on March 29th, and amendments were due to my office by April 13th. We have three amendments before the committee this afternoon. We will do public testimony before we take up amendments, but first I'd like to give Representative Sponholz an opportunity for any opening comments. No opening comments. Wonderful. With that, I'm going to open public testimony on House Bill 265. Is there anyone in the room wishing to testify? Seeing no one, we will move online. It looks like our first testifier in Anchorage is Crystal Nichols. Welcome to House Finance, Ms. Nichols, if you could state your name, affiliation, and please begin your testimony. Brief at ease. House Finance back on record at 4:14. We lost our caller there, so we're going to move to Nome at Norton Sound Health. Lance Johnson, welcome to House Finance. Please state your name, affiliation, and begin your two-minute testimony.
Thank you. Co-chairs Merrick Foster, members of the Finance Committee, for hearing testimony today on HB 265, for which I am in full support. For the record, my name is Lance Johnson. I'm the Administrative Director for Behavioral Health Services here at Norton Sound Health Corporation in beautiful Nome. Prior to the public health emergency, many people benefited from the effective use of video telehealth for the delivery of limited medical and behavioral health services. And during the pandemic, we've seen how the ability to offer even more services through video has positively impacted the health and wellness of the people we serve. Video is fantastic, but I want to focus a little bit on the extreme importance of the audio-only services that have come with this relaxation of telehealth and why we need to keep it in place. Speaking through the behavioral health lens, we found that some people prefer telephone services because they can have them in an environment of their choice that feels safe to them, not requiring them to go to a village clinic or office where their family might work or there are other barriers to care. This includes a housebound client who effectively completed an intensive substance use program. By his own admission, having the ability to receive that treatment through audio services, if he didn't have it, he wouldn't be here today. And this is just one of many success stories. I want to give you a near real-time example of what will happen if our audio-only flexibilities disappear. This week, without knowing if the PHE was going to be extended at with the deadline coming here at midnight of Friday, we began calling and rescheduling our clients to do video or in-person service when possible. Several of these people decided they would just go it alone if they couldn't talk to a provider through the means that they have become comfortable with, have allowed themselves to be more vulnerable through, and have made real progress. At the clip that we were losing people through rescheduling to non-audio services, anecdotally, mind you, I expected at least 30% of those clients to drop, and those are just the ones we call for next week's appointment. All we were doing is putting up an old barrier to access and progress once again. I want to leave you with this. For over 10 years, behavioral health providers have been able to provide a Medicaid-covered crisis intervention service via telephone. If we've been saying for over a decade that we can effectively stabilize someone in crisis at their most vulnerable, and by the way, we are effective, then certainly we can effectively offer an hour of psychotherapy by phone. I appreciate your taking up this incredibly life-changing bill, and I look forward to seeing it pass out of committee today. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Johnson. Any questions from the committee? I see none. Thank you so much. Next, we have Wynn Davis at the Alaska Native Health Board in Anchorage. Welcome to House Finance. Please state your name, affiliation, and begin your two-minute testimony.
Hello, co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is Wynn Davis, senior policy analyst for the Alaska Native Health Board in Anchorage, and I am testifying on behalf of ANHB. ANHB fully supports this legislation. Telehealth access during the COVID-19 pandemic has improved access to healthcare. The flexibilities have allowed for expanded behavioral health access through telehealth and has increased care in rural Alaska with telephone audio-only visits. I wish to be clear, these flexibilities have saved lives in rural Alaska, and this bill will allow for these life-saving services to continue. This legislation also ensures Medicaid reimbursement for important services provided through telehealth, such as behavioral health care. It is critical for our providers and patients that the delivery of these services are reimbursed at a level which makes them sustainable. For our rural patients, particularly our village-based patients who primarily live off the road system, the ability to use telephonic audio-only services has made it easier to access services because broadband connections are frequently unreliable or non-existent. Improved telehealth access has not only allowed for patients to more easily access their providers, the legislation would allow patients to access care from the safety of their home, decreasing travel from their communities and helping to decrease no-show rates for appointments. One of our members, operating out of Fairbanks, has shared that losing telephonic telehealth as an approved option would be a significant loss. Internet connections in the interior are not always reliable to have audio-video sessions, so having a telephonic visit is at times the only option. They noted their behavioral health services are currently 60% telehealth, a combination of video calls and telephonic-only calls. They have also received patient feedback from their elders who prefer telephonic encounters over sessions where you must use video equipment. Earlier this week, our behavioral health providers were scrambling to plan how to transition patient care away from the current telehealth flexibilities if the public health emergency ended. One of our rural Alaska behavioral health providers in the Northwest Arctic shared that they are looking at a cliff of access loss. Their substance use program has 100 active clients who will be left without care if these telehealth provisions are not adopted. These are patients who are accessing services 3 to 4 times a week who will suddenly lose access if they are not in the villages that have a working internet connection or an in-person ability to meet with a provider. Keep in mind that these village staff also must manage how to do multiple appointments throughout the day in a one-room, one-video system clinic if home-based audio-only delivery goes away. There are real-world ramifications to the loss of telehealth access for these patients. There will be much longer waits for family reunification because patients will not be able to complete counseling for OCS or probation, higher rates of suicide, domestic violence, and alcohol-related deaths. There will also be increased travel costs and staff burnout as providers will have to fly staff out with high caseloads to villages weekly, interrupting their ability to see patients. These are the lives at stake if these telehealth flexibilities last. We urge the committee to act quickly to advance this critical legislation. If we do not act now, Alaskan patients are at risk of losing telehealth access for essential health care services. I thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Davis. We appreciate you calling in. Questions from the committee? I see none. Is there anyone else in the room or online wishing to testify on House Bill 265? Seeing none, I'm going to close public testimony. And with that, we'll take a brief at ease. House Finance on the record at 4:21 p.m. I am going to reopen public testimony on House Bill 265. We were having some technical difficulties, so great. First, it looks like Renee Gayhart with the Director of Healthcare Services with DHSS. Ms. Gayhart, are you here for public testimony or for questions?
Just for questions. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. And then it looks like in Anchorage, we have Emily Nenon with the American Cancer Society. Welcome to House Finance. Please State your name, affiliation, and begin your two-minute testimony.
Thank you to the chairs and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Emily Neenan. I'm the Alaska Government Relations Director for the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. Here to just really encourage and compliment all the in-depth work that has been done to make this bill a reality. We all have seen the tremendous change and development in telehealth utilization and innovation during the pandemic. And this bill is going to make it just putting those things into a law ongoing is going to make a huge difference for cancer patients. As an example, when the state's emergency order ended, Seattle Cancer Care Alliance started calling all their Alaska patients. I've talked to their staff to get a little bit of backstory, but they had to start calling all their Alaska patients to cancel their appointments. So I started getting, this is really how I became aware of how huge an issue this is. I started getting calls from folks saying that they had been told they either needed to fly or had to cancel their appointment. That was for an out-of-state provider. I really appreciate the work that's been done to develop some oversight and patient protections for those kinds of cases. And just one more quick example of great example of really maximizing the ability of telehealth was something I heard from a radiation oncologist in Anchorage who was working with a rural patient and was able to do that introductory education visit with the rural patient by telehealth. And then the patient was able to then be with their family, make the decision, yes, I want to go forward with this radiation treatment. By the time they got to Anchorage, all the prep work had been done, and they were able to just jump right in and get the treatment started, as opposed to having to pull everybody into Anchorage, fly back home, and then have that lag time. So great work has been done. Look forward to seeing some of these innovations to increase patient access to care in Alaska. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Neenan. I see no questions from the committee. We appreciate you calling in and for your patience today. I see no one else in the room or online wishing to testify. I'm closing public testimony on House Bill 265. That takes us to amendments. Amendment number one on House Bill 265 is by Representative Josephson. Representative Josephson, do you have a motion?
Brief
at ease. Finance on the record, Representative Josephson.
Move Amendment 1.
There's been an objection. Representative Josephson.
Madam Chair, I'm offering this amendment at the request of the bill sponsor to speed up and simplify implementation of the legislation. The amendment deletes the final two pages of the bill, 9 and 10, and replaces the delay effective date and contingency provisions contained in those sections with a simple immediate effective date. The primary purpose of this legislation is to continue useful telehealth activities authorized under the public health emergency. Federal emergency service is currently scheduled to expire this July. The effective date of the current bill is June 30, 2023, which would leave a year gap in telehealth authority. The bill provided the one-year delay in order for the Department of Health and Social Services and the licensing boards of the Department of Commerce to adopt regulations. However, it is my understanding that the current version of the legislation does not require any regulations prior to implementation, so the Department of Commerce does not object, I think I'm right about this, to an immediate effective date. The other element of the bill being deleted by my amendment is the language related to state submission of a Medicaid state plan amendment in sections 8, 10, and 11 on pages 9 and 10. Before the telehealth payment provisions found in section 5 of the bill take effect, sections 8, 10, and 11 require a series of actions related to federal approval that we now believe are unnecessary and therefore deleting by this amendment. First, Section 8 requires the Department of Health and Social Services to request approval for a Medicaid state plan amendment from the federal government to the, quote, extent necessary, close quote. Then Section 10 makes the telehealth payment section contingent on the federal government responding to the state plan amendment requested by January 1, 2023, responding either by approving the plan amendment or determining the amendment was not necessary. Finally, Section 11 makes the payment section take effect the day after the revisor statutes is informed of the federal response. I would defer to bill sponsor Representative Spahnholz to answer follow-up questions about the Medicaid state plan amendments. But it's my understanding that the federal CMS has released guidance that states do not need a plan amendment to pay for telehealth services if they are furnished in the same manner as if the service were furnished in person. Furthermore, it's my understanding the Department of Health and Social Services believes there is no requirement for a Medicaid state plan amendment based on a community substitute. In conclusion, and it's amazing that I can do this without reading credit, in conclusion, I'm offering this amendment because the bill does not need to delay its effective date or to include language to require a state plan amendment. Thank you.
Thank you. Further discussion? Hearing none, is the objection maintained? The objection has been removed. Is there further objection? Hearing none, Amendment number 1 has been adopted. Amendment number 2 by Representative Rasmussen. She is online. Representative Rasmussen, do you have a motion?
Yes, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I move Amendment 2.
I'll object for purpose of discussion. Representative Rasmussen.
Yes, thank you. This amendment was also at the request of the bill sponsor, and currently, there are Alaskans who seek specialty treatment out of state for care that's unavailable to Alaska, particularly for rare diseases or cancer treatments. The Alaska patient choosing this care should be spared unnecessary travel and expenses when a telehealth visit is sought by the patient, and telehealth would meet the physician and patient needs. This amendment was developed upon thorough input and support from ASMA, ASHNA, and the American Cancer Society Action Network Alaska chapter. Because in-state healthcare delivery from non-Alaska licensees is unprecedented in state law, and Alaska has not joined any interstate healthcare compacts, this amendment is a significant step forward in modernizing Alaska's healthcare access via telehealth. Happy to answer any other questions.
Thank you. Further discussion on Amendment number 2. Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe if we have a representative from Hess on the phone or the bill sponsor could help me understand. If there's a provider out of state that is treating an Alaskan, does the out-of-state provider have any licensing obligations to the state of Alaska? They may be licensed, say, in the state of Washington, for example. Which providers have an obligation to become licensed in the state of Alaska?
Thank you. Representative Spahnholz, welcome back, if you would place yourself on the record.
All right. Thank you very much, Madam Co-Chair. And Representative LeBon, through the chair,
Representative Spahnholz, if you could please.
Thank you so much for the reminder. Appreciate it. It's been a long day. Yes, Representative Ivy Spahnholz, representing House District 16 in Anchorage. And the very narrow exclusion that we're prescribed, that we're advancing here, that Representative Rasmussen is advancing, would be for only for follow-up care for medical providers who have already delivered in-person care, and they are, in this particular example, not required to be licensed in the state of Alaska. There was an earlier version of the bill that had much more expansive authority for providers that were not licensed in the state of Alaska to practice in Alaska, and that has been stripped out in collaboration with stakeholders. This is a very much compromise language that is designed to ensure that Alaskans can get access to continue to get access to specialty care without unnecessary travel, but without reducing Alaska state sovereignty and our ability to enforce sanctions against potential bad actors that may be out there, and that's the reason that we're proposing this compromise language.
Representative LeBon, thank you very much. Further discussion on Amendment number 2. Representative Carpenter.
Co-Chair Merrick, it might be best that that question go to Director Sarah Chambers of Business and Professional Licensing, who's available, and she can talk a little bit about the process. We worked with her on this amendment.
Thank you. Ms. Chambers, if you could place yourself on the record.
Thank you, Co-Chair and members of the committee. This is Sarah Chambers, Director of the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing. And the amendment allows the board the ability, as it has now, it allows the board the ability to work with the division to conduct an investigation, gather information regarding a complaint that may be filed against a physician that does not hold an Alaska license, and go through the process that we utilize right now, ultimately culminating in a medical board decision to either continue or the physician's practice, or in the state of Alaska, it has no bearing on their license in another state, or to relieve them of the ability to practice under this exemption. So it would be the same process that we use right now, going through an investigation under the Administrative Procedures Act, and then a board sanction if there is finding of a violation.
Representative Carpenter?
Okay, thank you. So I think I've figured out how to answer my question. The Administrative Act that you referenced, what is the process for due process on the doctor or physician that's out of state? This amendment is saying that we're going to notify other states that action's been taken. What I don't see in the bill, what I don't see in the bill or the amendment is an understanding of how the doctor gets to have a rebuttal or present a defense to the accusations. And I think that might be within the administrative process, if you can speak to that.
Ms. Chambers?
Yes, certainly. Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, you're exactly right. There is, under the Administrative Procedures Act, a process that is also echoed a bit in this amendment on page 3, line 22, discussed the physician's ability to have a hearing within a very short amount of time, 7 days, and so this is already in statute. It isn't superseding other areas of statute, and it does reinforce the physician's ability to have a hearing if the board reaches a decision that might relieve them from this ability to practice in the state of Alaska. The Administrative Procedures Act also includes a appeal process. So if a physician doesn't agree with the medical board's decision, it can certainly go through the Office of Administrative Hearings, and then the Superior Court, and then the Supreme Court if they want to take it that far. So there's a robust process in place that this would align with.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Kutcher. On page 3, line 2, number 9, So it's on page 3, line 2, promptly notify the licensing authority of each state. Does that occur before an appeals process has run its course, or after all appeals and due process has run its course?
Ms. Chambers?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, once there is a sanction imposed by the board, then we are bound by existing Alaska statute, as well as certain federal requirements for healthcare disciplinary reporting, to make sure that other states are notified. So this is consistent with our current processes under state law for physicians. It just extends those same processes to those unlicensed physicians working on Alaskans.
Representative Swanholtz?
Thank you, Representative Carpenter. I think it was the last thing that Director Chambers said is most operative, which is that essentially this amendment would create a process that exactly mirrors the process that we already use for Alaska license holders, if in the event that there is an issue that is addressed. But I also just want to clarify for the record and for anybody that may be watching, this is a very narrow exception that would only apply to providers who are not licensed in the state of Alaska and who are providing follow-up care. So We're mirroring the exact same process that's already in statute, but it would also just be a very narrow exception, a small very small number of providers that would fit into this category, mostly in specialty care, mostly oncology, psychiatric care.
Thank you, Representative Smallholz. Further discussion on amendment number 2? Seeing none, Representative Rasmussen and wrap up.
I just ask for member support. Thank you.
Thank you. I will remove my objection. Is there further objection? Hearing none, amendment number 2 has been adopted. Amendment number 3 by Representative Ortiz. Representative Ortiz, is there a motion?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I move amendment number 3.
Objection.
There's been an objection. Representative Ortiz.
Okay, thank you. Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, this language cleans up the controlled substance language per the recommendations from CBL Director Sarah Chambers via the office of Ms. Ponholz, of course, the sponsor. This language provides clarity to the telesprescribing of controlled substances. It cleans up language, ensures the bill is in compliance with federal law, and ensures regulatory equity between the state medical board and the Board of Nursing on teleprescribing controlled substances. And that's what the amendment does. I believe Ms. Chambers is still on the line to answer any further questions. You can find the amendment starting on page 2, line 11, and following it from that point on.
Thank you. Further discussion on amendment number 3. Representative Carpenter.
Ms. Chambers is online. Can we get an example of what cleans up language means? Like what is substantively?
Ms. Chambers?
Hi, this is Director Chambers. I'm just wanted some clarification on the question. I'm not sure I understand what's being asked.
Yeah, I'm not sure what cleans up the language means. So that's what I'm wanting some help with. An example or two of what clean up the language means.
Through the chair, thank you for that. So the areas that we raised some concern with and have been working with the sponsor to clarify are the two initial on the first page of the amendment, the two updates are to ensure that the state is also aligning with federal law. There was this is just sort of refining what a previous version of the bill included that may have gone a shade too far in superseding what the federal law allows for controlled substance providing. So we didn't want to put our providers who have prescribing authority into a tough spot. So this is just an alignment that's necessary by law. And then on page 3, following line 20, in about the middle of page 1, there's an edit to give the Board of Nursing some additional authority and clarity around that authority, that allowing them and requiring them to establish guidelines for prescription drug prescribing. And that's something that is not clear in statute currently and is as the representative said, bringing the clarity to the Board of Nursing statutes that exist in the medical board statute.
Representative Sponholz.
Thank you. Representative Carpenter, through the chair. I'll just clarify a little bit. This amendment is pretty important. It clarifies that controlled substances in the state of Alaska will only be prescribed in compliance with Federal Drug Enforcement Agency statute, which does not allow for prescription of an opioid without an in-person visit. And second, we inadvertently excluded the Board of Nursing from the ability to adopt regulations regarding the prescribing in an earlier draft. This is a very complicated bill, and we've been working with about 39 stakeholders on the bill, and we identified this oversight. And I want to thank Director Chambers for her thought partnership in crafting this amendment. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Sponholz. Representative Carpenter?
When you say we identified the oversight, who is we? And that was at a committee?
Director Chambers.
Thank you. Further discussion on amendment number three? Hearing none. Wrap up, Representative Ortiz.
I'm good, Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you. Representative Carpenter, do you maintain your objection?
So it's a significant change, and there is a very high level of trust required right now, because we're taking 5 minutes to talk about an issue that I don't fully understand. And it's a policy call. It's a policy decision in a finance committee. So I'm a little frustrated at the process right now that we're being asked to make a decision that's not fully clear to me.
Brief at ease. Finance on the record at 4:44 p.m. I'm going to allow Representative Ortiz wrap-up comments.
Sure. If I can ask members who are interested if they could go to subsection D and E. This provides, subsection D starts on what page here? Brief at ease.
So, finance on the record, Representative Ortiz.
This amendment amends subsection D and E. The provisions regarding teleprescribing of controlled substances to ensure the bill aligns with federal law, as the sponsor was just saying. This fixes language which could be interpreted to open out-of-state teleprescribing, which we do not want to do. So it narrows it further, as the sponsor was just saying. It deletes the phrase "in another state," making it clear that only Alaska licensed providers in subsections D and E can teleprescribe controlled substances. This aligns the in-person examination requirement then for teleprescribing controlled substances with the federal law. There's a federal requirement for a DEA registered practitioner to conduct an in-person examination in order to teleprescribe controlled substances. This requirement was waived only with the federal public health emergency. However, there is both an interest from the White House and from the National Healthcare Organization to change the in-person requirement. If so, we want to make sure the bill aligns with any federal law changes while eliminating state barriers to telehealth. There's more, or does this help in at all?
Do what you gotta do.
Well, I'm just doing it.
Please continue, Representative Ortiz.
Okay. Also, it add language to AS 08.68, giving the Board of Nursing the authority to regulate the telehealth of controlled substances for APRNs. This mirrors the regulatory authority of the State Medical Board with the Board of Nursing. The Board of Nursing has not been provided clear regulation adoption authority like that of the medical board in AS 08.64.101. When the House version aligned with the APRN's telehealth prescribing authority with physicians and PAs, there was language missing related to the board's regulatory authority. So again, there's more. Now there's actually not much more. think we're good. I mean, if that helps at all.
Thank you, Representative Ortiz. Do you maintain your objection, Representative Carpenter? The objection has been removed. Is there further objection? Hearing none, amendment number 3 has been adopted. We have no more amendments before us on House Bill 265. Is there further discussion? Hearing none, Mr. Co-Chair?
Yes, Madam Chair. I move House Bill 265, version 32-LS0754/D from committee as amended with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes and authorize legislative legal services to make conforming changes.
Is there an objection? Hearing none, House Bill 265 is moved from committee. Brief at ease. Finance on record at 4:49 p.m. This concludes our agenda for this afternoon. Our next meeting is tomorrow at 1:30. We will consider House Bills 291, extending the council on domestic violence, 308, dementia awareness, and 363, broadband. With that, at 4:49 p.m., we are adjourned. Thank you.